uncertainty over so many things. You've got the Fed.
Why the Fed has to keep lowering these rates and getting that forecast wrong?
Out, out, damn dot.
There is really a great deal of uncertainty around the appropriate level of rates.
You've got terror, and then, of course, there's that big EU vote.
Brexit was one of the factors that factored into today's decisions.
We think some of the headwinds that we have now are more permanent.
Many of us expect that these headwinds would gradually diminish over time, but there are also more long-lasting or persistent factors that may be at work that are holding down the longer-run level of neutral rates.
It is one of the single most pessimistic things I believe I've ever heard a Fed chair say.
The fun game to play is who's Debbie Downer on the dot chart.
Let's go back to the old days when Alan Greenspan would bring in that briefcase and we would have to figure out if it was heavy or not.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, a very historic meeting this week with the Federal Reserve. They're finally coming to grips that 3% economic growth is not a reality. In the new normal, 1 and 2% is probably going to be that reality. And they also lowered their interest rate projections for not only this year, going all the way out to 2018. The Fed is finally coming to grips with the new normal. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in hour one, Robin Griffith will be joining us. He thinks we're in a bear market. If you're going to get any kind of returns from stocks, it's probably going to have to be dividends, or if you're in bonds, mainly interest. He'll be joining me in the first hour. Dan Steffens will be here, and he says, take out your wallet, folks. Get ready for $70 oil by the end of the year. We're heading for $3 gasoline. And by the way, if you have that gas-guzzling SUV, according to Dan, you might want to start looking at your second car and make it an economy car. He'll be joining me in hour one. Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about this week's big events moving the market. All of that coming up in hour one.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, we're going to hear from Dr. Gary Schilling today during the Big Picture. We'll be running clips from an interview that was done for our premium channel. But we are actually approaching the end of the era of economic growth, according to Dr. Schilling. This is going to go on for another 6 to 8 years, 15 all total. Probability of another major recession right over the horizon. And we're going to be at historic low interest rates for some time. What does this mean? It means that it's going to be difficult times for savers and investors, so you need to plan accordingly. That'll be the substance of the Big Picture for today, right here on the Financial Sense News Hour. And Ryan Poplava, I is wondering, how's that? I is wondering right now. I is wondering, yeah. What's new on Wall Street? I mean, obviously, the Brexit is coming up next Thursday. That's going to be a big issue, but is that the key topic right now or something else? And I would guess that the anticipated economic impact, depending on which way the vote goes, it would be a subject of buzz on Wall Street.
Very much. I mean, that's a topic that really hits the macro themes in the market right now. And the market, for the most part, moves on macro themes. So, you know, I think I can safely say, yes, a lot of the concern and the increased usage of option contract hedges recently and that sort of protection this week has been increasing the uneasiness with just the results and headlines we've been seeing regarding those polls, you know, regarding that UK referendum next week. They've been definitely leaning on the leaving side of things over the past 2 weeks. And, you know, that's led to that increased fear. You know, a lot of the fear doesn't necessarily jump off the page regarding the UK alone, but with the assumed contagion over the rest of Europe kind of following suit, similar ideas there of what that would do to trade. And obviously, you know, John, the currency itself, the euro and the strength of it. So I think the biggest tragedy over the whole thing this week per se is just, I don't know if you heard about this murder in the streets over there.
An MP, yeah, member of parliament, right.
Joe Cox, a lawmaker for the Labour Party who, you know, she's just been a real big advocate for Britain to remain in the European Union. And, you know, the other items that have been weighing on sentiment this week has been the drop in sovereign yields. And just what does that signal? You know, it signals all these concerns about not necessarily what's going on with this potential referendum, but the results from it, you know, what's going to happen to the other nations in the EU, but also the kind of the signals we're getting from the central banks, like we heard from many of them this week. So those are the concerns right now on Wall Street. It's the anxiety over the Brexit referendum and essentially interest rates remaining lower for longer.
So what would we say? The volatility VIX index, which a lot of people call the fear index, it's gone up ahead of the UK referendum. And again, that's June 23rd, next Thursday. So that would probably be signaling that investors are hedging their investments against volatility. And that would also correspond with a drop in equity prices, you know.
Usually does, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that would be expected given where we're headed with the whole thing. The other item you mentioned, by the way, sovereign bonds. Now, why are those going down too, since you've been reporting better economic numbers in the U.S. here as of late, minus the employment data for May that we saw?
Well, the employment data, that was a really big key item. As we've been discussing on the show, that really dropped those Fed futures rate probabilities where the market sees a rate hike happening in June and July, really dropped those chances. And we were as high as in the 50% range for July before that data hit. So that was a very big key number. Yes, all the retail sales we've been getting, many others that have been really positive. We've seen the Empire Manufacturing Survey came out very strong recently for June. You know, but sovereign bond yields dropping does correspond with a flight to safety trade that may be caused by the increased anxiety for that referendum. But also, you know, there are many headlines addressing if the UK leaves, it will cause others to do so as well. So, you know, it's a vote of no confidence in the EU in general. And that's leading to these falling yields around the world and especially here in the States. Because, you know, John, if an investor has a global access to, you know, securities, they're looking at bonds over here at, you know, 1.6% for the 10-year. And then maybe, you know, a German investor looking at a German 10-year, that went negative for the first time in history on Wednesday this week. So, you know, if I have the opportunity to do one, lose money, or hey, make money and maybe in a currency that's been stable here, I'm going to choose the one that's going to make money. So that's keeping our yields down as well. Even though we've got good economic numbers overall over the last couple of months, definitely showing that GDP is headed in the right direction compared to the first and second quarter. You know, the other contributing factors to the drop in the bond yields over the past couple of weeks, as I mentioned, has been the drop in the chance for a rate hike this summer. The Fed met this week, signaled lower for longer, changed some of that language, wasn't as aggressive as Yellen saying that, you know, the opportunity is live at each one of these meetings. You know, she dropped that discussion. So definitely a more dovish conversation from Yellen. Also the dot plot, which we get every quarter, those estimates showing for only one hike this year went up from one member to now six are saying one. And then we had Bullard speaking this week, basically reiterating that fact that he thinks maybe only one hike this year. The other central banks are basically saying the same thing. They can lower them or they're holding them low for now and longer. You know, I often sense a lot of investors and investment managers look to the Fed for that vote of confidence in the economy. What are they signaling? That's how I should feel about the market. That's how I should interpret things. And so if they're signaling that they just don't know where things are and they're uncertain, then, you know, we can see what we did on Wednesday. The FOMC dialed down its language, went from something of we're going to be live every meeting is a possibility to something a little bit more dovish. And in the past, the market would rally on that, right? We're going to stay accommodative. Market goes up. You know, risk on. That didn't happen on Wednesday.
Well, I would guess that there must be other things going on aside from what I'm calling the Brexiety. That's the anxiety over the Brexit vote. And the dovishness right now on the part of our central bank, despite all of its proud boasting about its raising interest rates, it seems like it's holding back on that. What else are we looking at out there?
So we did get some more economic news this week. So the retail sales, those were up 0.5% in May, and retail sales do contribute towards GDP figures. So we like to see that those retail sales were above consensus, above estimates, and that's what we did see. And they were positive. You know, even excluding autos, which, you know, a lot of critics, you know, look at the retail sales figure and see, well, you know, autos are really high because interest rates are really low. Yes, that's true. But removing autos, they were still good. Retail sales were up 0.4% without autos in there. A lot of strength in gasoline sales, internet sales, and sport and hobby stores. Obviously, you know, summer's right around the corner, if not, you know, already here. So we're seeing some increase in that. Housing data was mixed. Permits were up. I think housing starts were down. I'm seeing some higher inflationary numbers, which we've been seeing. That's kind of been a theme for the last, I don't know how many months, 4 or 5 months. In comparison with, you know, the kind of numbers we had last year, that makes it easy for year-over-year comparisons in prices for gasoline. You know, oil prices have gone up. That's a very big contributor. In fact, looking at import prices, they were up 1.4%, but if you factor out fuel, they were only up 0.3%. So our thoughts have been great. We're off the bottom in oil, and that's helping with a lot of the concerns we had in the high yield segment. You know, a lot of concerns over the viability of some of these drilling companies, these oil companies with falling oil prices. We've had a significant bounce. There's still debate, you know, is the bottom in for oil? Is the bear market over in commodities in general? There's been a lot of discussion about that, you know, with higher gold prices, higher oil prices. But, you know, if energy prices continue to march higher, as some analysts have been predicting as of late, you know, easy to extrapolate, prices are going up, they're going to continue going up. You know, then we get into issues where higher prices hurt consumers. And, you know, I feel like oil prices are in a good spot right now. If they hold above 40 and if they stay below 60, sort of a Goldilocks moment, I guess, for energy and the U.S. consumer. Rig counts have gone up recently in the last 3 weeks. And I think that's the beauty of the free market and the ability of the U.S. to produce right now. If prices go up, the spigots turn on. U.S. production will keep prices in check for that consumer, which is 70% of our economy, and they need those prices to stay low so they can continue to pay down debts, continue to add a little bit to discretionary spending. And you and I, we talked about this, I think about a month ago, where we looked at, did an analysis, looked at retail sales, looked at, you know, why energy prices have gone down so much over the past few years, but why aren't we seeing the incredible amount of spending that we should be seeing? It's not a one-to-one relationship, John, and I won't go back into that because we did a month or so ago. But like I said, I think it's a sort of a Goldilocks moment for the U.S. as far as energy prices, which have rallied. We want to keep those low. We don't want to hurt the U.S. consumer. And I think because of our supply and the ability for rigs to come right back online very quickly, we've seen 3 weeks now of that happening. I think that'll happen. I think prices won't get out of control.
Okay, so it does look like we will finally get the market's reaction to the Brexit vote and all of the anxiety that investors are feeling right now. You know, do you suppose they're going to be laid to rest, or we simply determine a direction? You know, I mean, maybe the anxieties are going to be confirmed rather than disaffirmed by a vote to leave. And even then, it's not really clear what the fallout is going to be if they decide to leave, because it's going to take place over a couple of years. This isn't instantaneous. You know, there are all sorts of things that have to be set up. One thing is certain, it seems, though, but it's lower for longer, I guess, is the way we'd put it.
Yeah, I think if listeners take anything away from, you know, this discussion, it's again, the central bank's ability at this point, it's uncertain whether they're even being effective. You know, look at the yen in Japan. They've been trying to communicate that they're accommodative. And here we're seeing the yen going up, because I think investors over there don't really believe that the Bank of Japan is going to follow through with going further into negative territory, much more than they already have, and making it even more costly for investors to give the money to just the governments there and the central bank and banks doing that. But look at the yen strengthening, and that's keeping a lid also on the US dollar. That's helping gold prices. But yeah, definitely the efficacy of central banks is being called into question if you're just looking at the yen, and then also here in the States. Lower for longer, causing a bit of crowding in bonds at the moment. Short term, especially if prices are headed up for energy and labor costs, you know, that's kind of what I've been intimating here a little bit here. Prices have been going up. Inflationary expectations seem to be in check, but, you know, I don't know. Is that going to stay that way? You know, I think the employment data for June will be a very important piece of the puzzle over the next couple of weeks, obviously, besides the referendum vote next week.
Yeah, pretty much. So I noticed Mark Faber was saying getting out of the EU is in Britain's best interest. and there are other people that are arguing on the other side. All of the what I call the one world organizations are telling what a horrible thing this will be. But, you know, next week we'll be able to discern. We already know. We'll know what the results of that are. So we can go from there. Anyway, Ryan Poplava, holding my breath for the whole week, and hope to see you back again next week.
Sounds good, John. We'll talk about it then, see how the market reacts to that vote.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is attorney, author, and Forbes columnist Carolyn Rosenblatt. Let's talk about some of the issues that are arising today in the kind of retirement market we're seeing. A couple things have changed that. The security of defined benefit pension plans have gone away. We're dealing in an investment market where you're seeing negative, if not zero, interest rates. And what is happening is a lot of individuals are finding that they're ending up taking care of their parents. So let's begin with that. And the issues that this raises is mom and dad age.
Yeah, it's certainly becoming more of a problem than it ever was before because people are living longer than they ever have in the history of this country, in the history of the world for that matter. And it's great because everybody thinks longevity is wonderful, but we forget that our health span, that is the number of years that we remain healthy and independent, is not increasing in the same way that our lifespan is increasing. In fact, we're not doing so well with that. So there are more people who have impairments, age-related disabilities, and consequently a need for care. That is hideously expensive, so we've got to devise ways to address that. And families are finding that they have to take on more responsibility than they ever planned on.
Well, it's been a difficult time for the markets. We seem to be going up on the verge of breaking out to a new record, but we get right up to where we used to be and markets fall down again. Joining us on the program is Robin Griffiths. He's Chief Technical Strategist at the ECU Group. And Robin, it seems like we've been here before and we've been doing it quite often. We try to get up to that upper level of 2100. Maybe we got a little bit above it. We can't seem to hold it. What's going on here technically?
On my roadmap, we are in fact in a bear market now. The only two equity indices in the world capable of making a new high this year or next are the Dow and the S&P 500 because they're very, very close to their old all-time high. Put it this way, if they made a new high breakout, it wouldn't change my story. What they would need to do is go higher and then try and fall back and make a new low above what had been the old high. If they did that, I'm going to have to say my scenario has been wrong and made a mistake. So making a new high is easy to do. As we've known last year, you only need a few stocks covered by the name FANG to go higher. And they're such large market cap stocks that they were able to hold the index up or even make it go up long after the stocks that had traditionally been the backbone of corporate America were 25 to 30% off their highs. So I think we shouldn't be confused by those two indices possibly making a new high. The very fact that they're actually struggling to do even that tells us something. And it also tells us that, I mean, when you see in the news some of the most famous big old bad hedge funds are all taking up extremely risk-averse positions in metals like gold, it's telling you they're ready to go short of quite a lot of things. They're expecting a bear market further down leg. And most indices elsewhere in the world, away from the USA, are making that abundantly clear. They are, in fact, in a bear market. Over here in Europe, of course, we're worried that within a few days, Britain might vote for Brexit, but it won't alter the fact whether it stays in or out, that we're in a bear market anyway.
Robin, what kind of bear market is this? You know, when I think of a bear market, I'm sure our listeners are thinking of what happened, let's say, in 2000 with the bursting of the tech bubble, or the financial crisis in 2007 and 9, where basically the S&P 500 lost 45%. You know, we've been down a little over 10%. We get down there and then it takes off again. So we haven't seen the severe downward legs or the crashes in the market as previous bear markets. So what's making this different?
I don't think we need to fear a crash in the U.S. stock market. There are scenarios where that could develop, but that requires various events that haven't yet happened and may not happen. I don't think that the U.S. economy is going to go into depression or recession. Again, there are possibilities for that happening. But on our work, it looks as though it will simply go into quite a prolonged period of low growth. I guess you could call it subpar growth, but it is nonetheless growth. Somewhere between 1% and 2%. The exact number is not particularly important. The important thing is it's unlikely to be between 2.5% and 3.5%. And there's nothing wrong with that. But history shows that as long as you don't overpay for the earnings per share that you're getting in that period, you can still do okay with good individual stock selection. But the index itself doesn't do anything terribly exciting, so that the total returns you can expect are modest, very modest. Unfortunately, when you come down to the valuation basis of the U.S. stock market, that's wrong. By its own historic yardsticks, it's expensive. When you look at analyst forecasts, which they call forward earnings, I call artist imagination earnings, they managed to come out with a number about 16.5. And even that, anyone that read The Intelligent Investor or Ben Graham books or follows Mr. Buffett knows that cheap is 8 times earnings and 16 was expensive. If you actually look at the declared and audited earnings, it's 19.5, which is very toppy. And if you then use, if you're trying to be bearish, you use the cyclically adjusted multiple. It's as high now as it was in the peak in 1929, and there's only ever been exceeded by that peak that you mentioned, which at the top of the dot-com bubble back in the year 2000. But as that's what the statisticians call a five sigma event, the notion that we've got to have another one of those, by definition, they are incredibly rare events, deviations that much. But, we don't need a crash. I've got various heuristic rules of thumb, which we technical analysts use, which is that in a normal economic cycle, you basically get one presidential election cycle, you get a bull market and then a bear market. The bull market adds up very roughly to 3 good years, and the bear market is a fall of about 25% and fits into one further year. So around a 4-year cycle is up for 3, down for 1, and you're thinking in terms of 25%. So when you're off 10%, you're sort of halfway over. And incidentally, chart rules suggest that the shape on the chart of the bear market is always of a fall, followed by a significant rally, followed by the rest of the fall. And the whole thing about that rally in the middle, it has to be seductive enough to persuade a lot of people that actually it's back into the old bull market, which never died. Otherwise, the rally doesn't even take place at all. And that's roughly where we are. Once people realize, you know what, I think we are in a bear market, you get the rest of the fall back down to better value, hopefully good value, and the money returns to the market. What's happening at the moment is the public aren't buying this market. Most of the normal investment institutions aren't buying this market. 80% of all they're buying is companies buying their own shares back on borrowed money. And they're doing that because this year's directors will get a nice bonus if that happens. But they're actually making the market less good value and leaving it fully burdened with debt, which it didn't have to have. The fact that the cost of the debt is cheap is sort of irrelevant, really, for the good of the long-term outlook of the company. I think it is particularly in the USA where that's going on. It's not so much happening in other markets.
Robin, let me stop you there, because you're saying we don't need a market crash, but we are indeed in a bear market, not only here, but elsewhere. What does this imply for investors? Because so much of investment money is in index funds. In fact, the vast majority of the public has been going into index funds. And what you're saying is this is a market where if you're astute and do your homework, you can get good returns in individual stocks.
I think we're in an era when good return is going to be a much more modest number than we've become used to it being. I think modest returns are on the horizon. And the trick is to avoid losses, because history shows if you overpay for the earnings, especially up at these near 20 levels, there's a very high probability of you actually taking a loss somewhere in the next, you know, period of time, a reasonable period of time. I think collecting the dividend on your stock may be the best bit that you do, and not losing any money is the next part of the trick to try and get right.
I agree with you, especially when it comes to dividends, if you're looking at modest returns. But what about those stocks that are driving the index? You know, the FANG type stocks, those are the ones where you look at extreme valuations on many of those companies. Isn't there a risk to investors that, you know, you get on board the momentum train and then when you least expect it, you have a correction where you can lose a lot of money?
Absolutely. I think that's exactly where we are. I mean, it's not so long ago that Apple was the world's largest company, was one of the very stocks holding the market up. And then not very long turns around, you find it's down 35% from its high. Apple's a good company. What was wrong with it was the share price was too high. In England, we have this little nursery rhyme, 10 green bottles sitting on a wall, and one after the other, they do all fall. I mean, Google is clearly the biggest of the green bottles at the moment. And by fall, I don't mean anything going wrong with Google's business. What I think is the uptrend in its share price will fall and have a correction like Apple has done. And again, the sort of order of magnitude we're thinking about is 25% for a modest bear market, a third for a rather bigger one, and 50% for a very large one. Now, to be in the 50% category, you need to have a stock that really didn't have any earnings in the first place, and the share price was really very frothy indeed. And some of those FANGs certainly come into that category. And so I would have suggested they are vulnerable to drop when they do have a correction of about 50%. To go for a bear market greater than 50%, you're going for an extraordinarily rare event. They hardly ever happen. They do happen, but there's a monster ongoing secular downtrend when that happens. And I don't think the USA comes into that category. There would need to be events taking places that just don't look high probabilities to me. But from a frothy stock price, where there are very few earnings or the multiple is in the hundreds, as we know plenty of them are, or even almost non-existent on some of them, you're vulnerable to lose half your money. I mean, we know how glamorous stocks can look, and then you turn around and it's not really there afterwards. I mean, you think back to the Enrons of this world. These type of things do repeat. When we're looking at stocks like IBM, General Electric, you know, the backbone of old America, I think they're likely to drop about 25% from where they are now, because where they are now is almost the old highs of the market. That's the sort of downside I would be looking for. So not terrifying, but it means that anything in your portfolio that you don't really, really like and are prepared to live with for the long term, dump it. You're taking risks that you're not going to be well rewarded for. And you'd be much better off to say, I know I don't get much owing a treasury, but I am sort of guaranteed to get my money back when I need it to buy some bargains at some later time when life deals those cards to me. So as you mentioned, we're learning that in the new normal, a bond yielding what historically seems to be very little can still be a good investment, because you do get that yield, and you might even make a capital gain if the yield becomes even less. And in plenty of other countries, the trend is towards negative interest rates, not just low interest rates, but negative. And we certainly think they can persist for quite a bit longer. It's part of the new normal, which we're starting to learn what it involves.
You know, this is interesting because the Fed had a meeting this week. Not only have expectations come down for even two rate hikes, six of the Fed governors thought they would see only one, but also the Fed and Janet Yellen admitting that, you know, maybe in this new environment, what we define as the new normal, 2% growth rates is just one or two is all we're going to get. And certainly we're seeing the World Bank just lowered world global GDP growth this year down to 2.4%. So maybe this new normal is 2%. Robert, let's talk about two other areas of investing. We've seen lows in gold and in oil this year in February. Since February low up until last week, the price of oil has doubled. It's roughly in the upper 40s right now. What's your take on oil and especially gold here?
I don't see them in the same bracket. We know that gold is a commodity, but it's not performing like a commodity. It's performing like its role for thousands of years. It's real money, and it's treated as real money by Indians, Chinese, etc., and even the large-scale American hedge fund managers who are worried they're trying to preserve capital. And I guess the chart is saying to me that gold has actually been in a secular uptrend for a very long time, which began at about $250 an ounce. Within that secular trend, it's had several big surges and then setbacks. The first one was about 25%. The next one was about 30%. And then over the last 4 years, which is admittedly quite a long setback, it's fallen 40-something percent. But the low seems to be in now. If it breaks above 1,400, then I think there's a very real prospect of it going fairly quickly to the old all-time high of around 1,900. And of course, by definition, if it breaks 1,900, it's on its way to much higher highs. But by then, events would have unfolded in the world to make us all pretty worried and apprehensive and in the risk-averse mode par excellence. So at the moment, I see it going higher. I think the lows are in. I personally own an exchange-traded fund that owns gold. And you need to make sure that your fund has actually got some real metal backing it up, not just a promise from some institution that may go broke. So it's very important to check up on that. In the case of oil and all other commodities, though, I see that the rally that they had as being a bear market rally. And believe it or not, when you look back at history, how big can bear market rallies be? In a really cataclysmic bear market, you can get rallies of 50 to 100%. They're not only not exceptional, they're almost normal. So bearing in mind that oil came off $26 a barrel, it's allowed to go to 50 before the rally dies. Sorry, 52, I beg your pardon. It didn't quite make 52. It's been to 50, though. And I think it might just have another crack at 52. But after that, I do expect it to come back down again into the area where it made the base. So I would expect it to drop back again from the 50 to 52 area down into the 26 to 30 area and spend probably quite a long time making a base at that level. I think that the story that the glut in oil has disappeared, all the frackers are going to start making money again, I don't believe a word of it. There is absolutely no sign whatsoever that Saudi Arabia is about to give up market share to anybody. They can keep pumping at way lower levels than this, and they are, and they will. There isn't the demand for the oil that Stinger already in containers. The glut is slightly less than it was, but it's going to come back again as the price goes down, I think, because we're expecting the global economy to cool down, rather like the US one, not to a recession, but to a period of very slow, extraordinarily modest growth, and therefore the demand isn't going to go up. The second thing about the demand is we all know that lithium ion batteries, you know, every device that you touch and hold and becoming your motor car as well needs lithium ion batteries. And the more electric and clean we go, we used to put petrol in cars and people won't be doing that in the future. So the long-term demand for oil is becoming less anyway, driven by all sorts of issues of climate change and that sort of thing. So just broader on all the other commodities, including oil, the normal cycle time for the well-known commodity cycle, this is a bit early for the final low to be in place anyway. It looks on my work as though the final low is always going to come next year, probably later next year. And therefore, this rally that we've had was just a bear market rally. And it was very V-shaped when you plotted on the chart. And whenever you see a violent V-shaped rally, it's nearly always bears covering their short position. They've got a profit. They don't want the profit to evaporate. So as soon as there's a rally, they have an urgent need to be a buyer. Whereas a long-term buyer, a Warren Buffett type buyer, he doesn't deal like that. he identifies a price where the thing is damn good value, and he might buy the entire company, and he allows the stock to come to him. If it rallies away, well, he just sits back waiting for it to come again. So most of those rallies, especially the oil, were V-shaped, and therefore short-covering rallies, not long-term buying rallies.
So in this kind of market, as you talk about, we're going to see much, much lower returns. And even if you're a good stock picker, the returns are going to be much lower than the past. And if you're a bond investor, certainly we're looking at the lowest interest rates in recorded human history. So in this kind of environment, it's going to be a different investment strategy, it sounds like to me, Robin, where you're going to get the majority of your returns, whether it's interest from a bond or dividend from a stock, where in the past, investors were always looking for capital appreciation and growth. But in this kind of market, that growth seems to be elusive and much more probable when you get something that's more predictable. In other words, if I buy a stock and I get a good dividend yield, that is certainly a lot more predictable than making the forecast that the stock is going to go up in price.
Yes, I think that's exactly. It sounds less glamorous and exciting, but it's actually old-fashioned investing coming back. You don't expect to buy something and have it go up 25% per annum for long. The fact that we've been through eras when that can happen doesn't mean it's going to carry on. It's abnormal. It's artificial. You can only do that if you start from bombed out extremely low levels of valuation. And not only does the earnings grow, but the rating that you put on those earnings grows with it. When you've got the ratings into the stratosphere, you can't do that anymore. So, and I think the way forward is to have a well-diversified set of risks, and owning indices rather than stocks is a way of achieving at least that to some extent. I think they need to be geographically diversified as well. I mean, the world is your oyster, not just your own home market. And indeed, some of our own best companies are themselves extraordinarily internationally diversified. So they're doing part of that for us. Expect the dividend. If the multiple goes too high, be willing to sell it and say, if the price comes back, I'll buy that because I like the company. I just don't like its share price, and buy it back again. And I think you also need to diversify into other asset classes. And this is one of the reasons, well, certainly the reason why I've owned gold for a while, because it's a different asset class. It shouldn't be well correlated with equities and bonds. You do need some government bonds. I think we are learning that for the next 5 or so years, picking up a safe, guaranteed yield of a treasury bond or a British gilt is not such a bad result. You do get your money back. It opens up options to buy something else if a value bargain opens up for you. But meanwhile, you get a return. And as people say, it's the return of your money, not a return on the money, which is not normally guaranteed. So that's worth something. And also having some liquidity available to you, that's a good position to be in for surviving a tough time and to be able to pick up a bargain if life suddenly does deliver you. I mean, if you remember 1987, we had a crash, but it was all over in a few months. And the people that did well on the actually did well on the crash because they had some money available to buy it on the short, sharp drop that we had. We can't, by definition, predict that we'll have a flash crash like that. But we know that such things can and do occur. For example, supposing Britain votes to go out of Europe, the book is saying they won't vote like that, but supposing they do, we could easily have a wobble or whatever you want to call it on our markets, and somebody with the money can whip in on the day and just, that was an easy 15% I just made by having the money available. I think this is where we are now, and we live in such a joined-up world that we do need to follow the news flows from all over the world. We need to follow what the Chinese are doing. We need to follow what's happening in Europe, even if we're only going to buy stocks in our own, in your case, U.S. stock market, because the world is that joined up nowadays.
Well, listen, Robin, as we close, if I was to sum up here, as an investor, you're going to have to be more nimble. If you want to be diversified, it would make some sense to have some government bonds looking at your return coming from the interest and maybe some good dividend paying stocks. But as you point out, if things get elevated as they do from time to time, Don't be afraid to take some profits and keep some cash around to buy it back at a cheaper price. If our listeners would like to find out how they can follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
Well, I do have a website, ecugroup.com, and on that I put a certain amount of material. I also have a monthly newsletter, but it's important to say that the newsletter is designed to be read by and priced for the large institutions to be its customer base. It isn't particularly aimed at private individuals, or rather, they'd need to be very high net worth private individuals before it would be up their street. But we do put a certain amount of other stuff for free on the website, which is of general interest. So they would pick that up on ecugroup.com's website.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Neil Dutta, the head of economics at Renaissance Macro Research, joins us today. And Neil, when we last spoke to you, it was late January of this year, and there was a lot of fears that the global economy may be tipping into recession. The markets were imploding. And at the time, you told our listeners that no, the global economy was not going to implode, and that you didn't see imminent signs of recession here in the U.S. as well. And you even said at one point that you thought that the markets were underpriced, given some of the things that you were looking at. So here we are, fast forward 6 months later. Has your view changed at all when you look at the global economy? And let's talk about the U.S. as well.
Well, so the markets are up from that last time we spoke. So, you know, I think a lot of that has been the pricing out of recession risk, not only in the U.S., but globally as well. Obviously, the last employment report was spooky. You saw a sharp slowdown in payroll growth for May. But, you know, if you take a step back here and just sort of average out the first 5 months of the year, payroll growth is running at about 150,000, and wage growth is running slightly above 3%. You know, I feel pretty good about the economy given those sorts of numbers, if that were sort of to persist going forward. I think the big story coming out of Q2 has been the sharp rebound in consumer spending. You know, while the headlines around the retail industry have been pretty dire, with stories of department store shuttering and sort of empty commercial real estate lots, you know, retail sales in the second quarter has been growing at a pretty brisk pace. Real consumer spending is close to 4% in the second quarter, which is a pretty strong number. And I think the housing market data has generally been better. Home sales, both in new and existing, have been picking up. And if households or individuals are signing contracts on new homes, I think it's going to benefit consumer spending going forward. Because once you sign a contract on a new house, you buy furniture and appliances and floor coverings and household products after doing so. So I think that sort of sets a good tone to the outlook for consumer spending in the second half of the year. So if U.S. consumers are hanging in there, then I think the economy is going to be fine.
Well, here we are in summer when driving season picks up and the demand for gasoline increases. Just at a time we thought we were going to be seeing much lower oil prices, could we be heading back to over $3 a gallon? And even if we do, there's not much we can do about it. Joining us on the program is Dan Stevens from Energy Prospectus Group. Let's talk about where we are in this cycle. You recently wrote an article where you said much higher oil prices are coming to us this year, and you're looking at $70 to $80 oil. Let's talk about why you believe the oil markets are going to soon be back into balance, and what we've just gone through, let's say from 2014 to, let's say, February of this year. This two-year cycle is no different than the cycles that have preceded it.
Well, you know, the lower prices have an impact on the producers and the consumers. So you get the producers cutting back on capital spending, drilling completion, and you get, consumption going up. You get higher SUV sales, higher pickup sales, and, you know, people drive more because they can afford it. But it's really the decline in drilling and completion. And the reason I think the second half of this year is going to see a steady increase in oil price, because I think we're going to see a pretty steady decline in non-OPEC production. I think the U.S. is declining about 100,000 barrels per day per month. If you took all non-OPEC producing countries together, it's probably about 200,000 barrels per day per month. And there's been a big drop in the active rig count just since the first of the year, and there's a lag effect on that. So I think we'll see the effect of that in the third quarter.
I want to talk about how quickly things can change based on perceptions. I mean, if you go back to February this year, Dan, we got down to 26. There were predictions of $10 oil. And just in a short period of 3 months, the price of oil doubles. Let's talk about what was going on, even though the price of oil was declining. Let's talk about what was going on in demand, because China's demand for oil is still increasing. In the first quarter of this year, the IEA talked about a 1.4 to 1.6 million per day year-over-year increase from 2015. They're also forecasting a big spike in demand to around 1.3 million barrels a day from the second quarter to the third quarter as we go through this driving season. But let's talk about, what is it about the oil market that on a dime, out of nowhere, all of a sudden perceptions change quickly, and now the markets react to any little event, and they spike higher?
Well, if you're a conspiracy theorist person, you believe that some of these Wall Street firms are intentionally saying everything they can to drive it down as far as they can, and once they get it there, then they just suddenly flip-flop and start talking about how the markets are tightening and everything. Well, which fundamentally, they're going to tighten anyway, because, you know, with any commodity, once the price of the commodity, oil in this case, goes below finding a development cost, you're going to see a drastic decline in drilling and completion activity. And the thing is, particularly about oil, it is consumed in such enormous quantities. I mean, we're up to 96 million barrels a day, and within a few months, it'll be 97 million barrels a day of refined products are consumed every day. And just a small surplus can create a big decline in price, and a small deficit in supply can create a big spike in the price. And that's why if you did a 50-year chart of oil prices, you're not going to see a smooth line. You're going to see drastic spikes and valleys in that chart, and it happens every time. So once the market tightens, once supply and demand get very close together, then you start to see the impact of unanticipated outages. So when these Canadian fires took about a million barrels a day, up to a million and a half barrels a day of Canadian oil out of the supply side, and you see this violence in Nigeria continuing to go on, I think they're down 800,000 barrels a day. Those things tend to impact the traders a lot more than when they're sitting here thinking that we got this big surplus and we got all this oil in storage. Then, you know, unplanned outages at that point don't really impact trading that much, but they will as the market tightens.
Getting back to your point that eventually prices bring the markets into balance, and one of the things you talked about in your article, year over year in the month of May, oil production was down close to 600,000 barrels a day. Meanwhile, year over year, global oil demand is up by 1.6 million barrels. So eventually, the drop in production, the increase in demand, eventually those two things come into balance. But what really struck me is, for example, the Canadian oil fires took 1.5 million barrels offline. In Nigeria, terrorist attacks have brought Nigerian production down 800 to 900,000 barrels a day. It just goes to show you, Dan, as big as the world oil market is, how fragile it is, where you can have an environmental event in Canada or terrorist events in Nigeria and Libya, and all of a sudden, you've got millions of barrels disappearing off the market.
Yeah, right. And it's a market with very big numbers. And that's something that when I talk to people, they just can't really comprehend the size of those numbers. And, you know, they see something that says, oh, we have 3 billion barrels of crude oil in storage. Well, 3 billion barrels is only like a 1 month supply. So it isn't like that's a massive supply. And here we have something as important to our standard of living as a steady oil supply. And so it's very fragile, like you said, and we still get a lot of our oil production from countries where there's you know, terrible governments and unrest constantly. So that supply's at risk. And, you know, as our oil production in the United States is on steady decline, we're back to, again, importing over half of our oil supply. We're just very dependent on it. And the speculators see this coming, and they'll start bidding up the price again.
Now, in your estimation, within 6 to 9 months, demand for oil is going to be exceeding production, and these high storage levels will provide us a cushion, which means maybe we won't be over $100 oil. But if you and I were having this conversation December 31st, Dan, where would you think we'd end up the year on the price of oil?
Yeah, I still thought this would be the year when the turnaround, because there is a lag effect. And the reason these cycles last 2 years is because when the price drops, it takes a good 6 to 9 months before the industry to really slow down. I mean, once they've got their drilling programs kind of set in stone, they're going to stay there. They've got rig contracts. They've got commitments. And even though, like in June of 2014, the price dropped significantly, the rig count, active rig count, continued to go up and peaked in October of 2014 before it really rolled over. And just to put some numbers to it, the active rig count in rigs drilling for oil in the United States got to 1,609 rigs in October of 2014, and today it's about 350. So you can see the drastic decline in drilling activity. And then that is reflected in completions, which is, you know, it's completing a well as it brings on new supply, not the drilling of them. So there's even another lag effect from the drop in the drilling rig activity to a drop in the completion activity. And so it took well into 2015 before you saw oil production. In fact, U.S. oil production peaked in like April or May of 2015. And it's, since then, it's been on steady decline.
Now, you're making a prediction that when you usually go through these periods of time, it usually doesn't end up well on the other end. In other words, just as we went to extreme on the downside, typically in these cycles, we go to extremes on the upside because you got a lot of short positions in the oil market and these traders have to cover. And we've seen it in the last couple of years in terms of automobile sales. Truck sales are at record levels. My goodness, here in California, try to pull in a parking lot. It's very difficult to get space because everybody's buying these gas-guzzling SUVs. You're telling everybody you might want to get a second car that's an economy car.
Yeah, I don't know what it is about Texas, but I think about 80% of the women drive a big SUV. They may be more comfortable in it.
Think of California. It's the same.
It's the same way. People just love that comfort, and they love the horsepower, so they buy them. And I think they're just convinced that, you know, they believe these stories that, you know, oil will never hit 100 again. You'll have gas prices down below $2 a gallon forever. And then they can justify going out and buying a vehicle that burns that kind of gasoline. But anyway, I think they're going to regret it. Here in about a year, we'll probably be back to $3 gas. I don't know. Now, I am not predicting $100 oil anytime soon. And what's really happened and why these cycles in kind of a weird way kind of do help the oil sector is that they force these companies to, you know, kind of look at their cost structure. And the well costs have come down significantly. You know, they've got more time. They don't have a gun to their head to drill more, you know, wells as fast as they can. So the engineers have time to kind of focus on refining their completion techniques and stuff. So we've seen about a 30% decline in drilling and completion costs. So 70 is probably the new 100. If the upstream companies can get back to $70 a barrel, we're probably making the same level of profit as we were making at $100 a barrel. Now, some of the drilling and completion costs will come back up because a big part of those costs is fuel. It's fuel to run the rigs and fuel to run all the equipment that does the big frac jobs. And, you know, frac sand prices have come way down. Those will rebound quite a bit. And you'll get some of it back. But probably about half of those savings will stay because they're engineering savings.
I want to talk about some of the broader implications of this. And we've seen CapEx spending by major companies to mid-tier and small companies be slashed. But more importantly, Dan, you know that when you have 200,000 to 300,000 oil workers that have been laid off, this isn't something that you flip a switch and you got rigs out there pumping out oil like you do, let's say, a factory ramping up its production. So if I'm an oil executive, I've cut my payroll, I've slashed spending, We know that the large oil companies are only replacing about 70% of their reserves. Nobody's going out and buying large tracts of oil leases. How long will it take this industry to ramp up again to meet demand? Because if I'm an oil company, okay, I'm happy that the price of oil has gone from 26 to 50. But how sure am I that this is going to last before I have the confidence to make those billion-dollar investments and ramp up things? Don't you think we need an extended period of higher prices before the industry responds?
Yeah, there's a couple things, and one of them is you hit on the number of people that have been laid off, but also the equipment that hasn't been maintained properly. I was talking to one of our clients the other day that runs an oil field service company that really does logistics, which is like when a company decides on their drilling plan, they go out and they line up the rigs, they line up the completion crews and all the supplies and everything you need to complete the wells. And they're saying that they told me that if oil goes to $100 tomorrow, you might see an uptick in the rig count of 10 to 20%, but above that, it's going to take a long time to rehire and train the people. There's been a lot of equipment that, as it just sits out in the field, as these rigs and especially the frac crews and the fracking equipment just sits out there in the field and hasn't been maintained properly, it's in pretty bad shape. So it's going to be hard for them to get that back out there. So it would probably take well into next year before you see an increase in the activity. Now, another thing is on the financial side for these companies, these upstream companies, the one thing they have to do is they have to repair their balance sheets. They got to get back in favor with their bankers that have, you know, slashed their credit lines. So they don't have access to the capital. Now, some of the larger caps do, and they're at a tremendous advantage in these cycles because they have access to the capital. But these small caps, and that do a lot of the drilling and completion activity in our country, they're pretty much cut off from the capital market. So they have to rebuild that trust. They have to be able to lock in through hedging these higher prices before they can commit to a, you know, significant drilling program. So to get back to like that 1,600 rigs, I don't see that happening for like 2 or 3 years. Now, it probably will have to double the active rig count, get to around 600, 700 rigs, just to stabilize U.S. production, to slow the decline. So that's going to take a while. And again, that's well into 2017 before that happens. So, and that's why you see these big spikes and valleys, because even when supply and demand come back in balance, you'll get, it goes the other way and demand exceeds supply. And I see that happen in the first half of 2017.
Well, let's talk about some of the bigger companies and the investment implications. So if I'm Exxon, Chevron, major oil company, year after year, the last couple of years, I'm only replacing 70% of the stuff that's going out the front door. They've cut back on CapEx spending. We know that, you know, from the time you find a project, drill it, bring it to completion, that takes time. What about if this oil market stabilizes and begins to increase, that the big guys say, you know what, there's no way I'm going to replace these reserves in the short term. It's much cheaper to go on Wall Street and replace my reserves by buying somebody else. Do you expect to see a wave of mergers when the oil market improves?
Yeah, you do see a wave of M&A activity at the end of these cycles. You know, the one thing is the boards have to explain to Wall Street why they make a big deal. So even at Exxon Mobil, you know, for them to go out and make a, you know, $5 or $6 billion acquisition of some company, they're going to have to justify that to Wall Street. So that comes into their thinking. You are seeing some M&A activity on some pretty significant deals happening. I don't know if you saw Range Resources merging with Memorial Resource Development, MRD, the other day. That creates a tremendous a natural gas company. You're going to see some of that stuff. Yeah, I've seen some pretty big asset transactions, not taking over full companies, but buying big asset packages.
Yeah, so maybe the next expiration wave will be on Wall Street instead of in the ground. So, Dan, I mean, you don't see $100 oil, so you think maybe $70 oil, and at $70, our guys can make a lot of money, just like they did at $100. What are the risks, for example, that we could see spikes to 100 if, for example, what's interesting in Nigeria, the new terrorist group there is not interested in stealing the oil so they can get money. they're interested in bringing the government down by destroying the oil infrastructure. So, you know, any kind of political event, I mean, imagine an attack on an oil facility in Saudi Arabia, what that would do to the oil markets. What are the chances in the next couple of years we're more likely to see those kind of spikes based on some kind of an event?
Yeah, that's what it would take. And you mentioned Nigeria. I also think Venezuela is in big trouble. They're having lots of violence down there. And obviously, their government totally is dependent on oil prices in several of these OPEC countries. And that's why $50 is totally unsustainable for about two-thirds of the OPEC nations. Yeah, once the market tightens, then any kind of unplanned outage can cause a major spike. And you mentioned an attack by ISIS inside Saudi Arabia would just be, you know, catastrophic to the oil markets. Where the fighting is now in northern Iraq and Syria, there really isn't any energy infrastructure in there to, you know, of any meaningful energy and infrastructure in there. So that's not really a big deal. But, you know, if we would get more aggressive against ISIS, say in Libya or other areas, you could see increased exposure to an unplanned outage. So that could happen. Yeah, it's just once supply and demand get into balance. And I'm not just the one saying it. If you look at the report that came out early this week from International Energy Agency, IEA, you will see that they're now predicting that supply and demand are balanced by the fourth quarter.
So given where we are today, we're close to $50 oil, what would you be doing as an investor? I mean, you know, obviously there's different risk tolerances for everybody out there. Some people don't like to take a lot of risk. If you were going to go in the energy patch right now, where do you think the best bargains are?
Well, the first wave in these cycles, and you're already seeing it, our top pick, our large cap group, we always at the beginning of the year pick 16 companies that we think are going to do, you know, really well this year. And that group is up over 30% already. Some of them up 70 or 80%. And because the hedge fund managers, they trust the larger cap companies. And those companies have more analyst coverage, so they're more familiar with them. So that's the first wave. And there's still some opportunity there, probably another 30 or 40% in that group. And then the next wave of money comes into the well-funded small cap companies. And so what you really need to look at is, do they have the liquidity? Are they still in compliance with all their bank covenants, and have their banks reviewed their credit facility, and they still have, you know, some leftover to draw down on their bank credit line? And do they have operating cash flow? And that's the one thing I look at. I value companies on operating cash flow. So can they live within cash flow? Can they grow production reserves within cash flow? And then do they have access to capital to fund their growth programs? If they don't, I mean, if they're looking on, we're going to have to keep issuing more stock, or we're going to have to keep issuing more bonds or something, then, you know, that's one I usually avoid. But the one thing is, there's a lot of small caps that have tremendous acreage positions. They just lack the capital. Now, that makes them incredible takeover targets. So, you know, there's another group to look at. But, well, two of the plays that and Wall Street's in love with them is this, the Permian Basin, because of the stacked pays. You've got 8 or 10 zones out there that are productive. So, you know, these companies that control a lot of acreage that's held by production, they've got tremendous running room. If oil just stays firmly above 50, they've got tremendous running room. And then there's a play up in Oklahoma. Some call it, the southern part is called Scoop. The top part is called Stack. That's just west of Oklahoma City. That's turning into a tremendous new oil play out there. And there's companies like Continental Resources, Cimarex, Newfield is one of our top picks out there. And Devon Energy just recently closed about a $2 billion acquisition just to acquire a bunch of acreage in the heart of that play. So it's getting a lot of attention. It would be getting a lot more attention if you didn't have, you know, kind of oil below $50 right now.
Final question, if I may. What about some of the majors? A lot of the majors have big offshore projects that take years and billions of dollars to complete. They also have acreage in very unstable parts of the world. I'm thinking of Shell in Nigeria, Eni. What about some of the big guys making acquisitions for safer plays domestically here in the U.S. in shale?
I can't believe they're not doing more of it. Now, you look at those companies like Conoco and Exxon. They do already have pretty significant positions in these plays, but I'm surprised they're not buying some of the larger companies. I could see Pioneer Natural Resources getting taken over by Exxon or somebody, or Concho Resources, another one's got huge acreage position in the really good part of the Permian Basin out there. Yeah, those are ones to watch. Now, frankly, I'm not too excited about anything deep water offshore. You know, those plays require tremendous capital investment up front, and it's often years before you get the first production. You know, in an oil market where it's kind of unstable, what if you, you know, go out and drill and you're depending on $75, $80 oil to make this thing economic, and by the time your platform's installed, your production platform, the oil's dipped below 50 again. The thing is with the shale plays, you can go out and you can drill a bunch of wells, hold the leases by production. It's almost like inventory. And then, you know, if price goes up, you can quickly ramp up drilling and completion activity. If the price goes down, you can kind of shut it down for a while until the price comes back. But you don't have that luxury in the offshore. And I really don't look that much at these international companies that are, you know, all over the place drilling these long-range projects. But the shale plays have really kind of changed the landscape. Now, a lot of people, you know, blame this crisis on the shale plays and they think it's going to solve everything. But the thing to remember is shale oil production is only about 5% of the global production. So expecting that 5% to be the swing producer is pretty, you know, out there, I think, as far as an expectation. And the most aggressive forecast I've seen is that U.S. shale production could maybe get to 10 million barrels a day, and that would be consistently having oil prices well up in the $100 range.
So, Dan, as we conclude, you feel by the end of the year we're going to be closer to $70 oil. We're heading towards $3 gasoline, and this is going to be the next trend that could last several years, just as this downtrend. So, at this point, given where markets are, would you be buying energy stocks?
Yeah, I think now's the time in the cycle to get into them. And I might tell your listeners that I take a hard look at natural gas, too. I think it's often neglected, and the natural gas market in North America is a totally separate market that does not, we don't import much gas except by pipeline from Canada, and they've got less to send us. So I see a much tighter natural gas market heading into the next winter, and I could see natural gas prices going up 50 to 100% in the next 6 months. So think about looking at the companies that have a lot of natural gas production, too.
All right, Dan. Well, listen, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, why don't you tell them how they could do so?
Well, they can just go to energyperspectives.com, and that'll get you to our website. And if you'd like to join, it's a subscription service to get all of our reports. We have newsletter every 3 weeks, but we also put out individual company reports on about 100 different companies per year, all in the energy sector, mostly oil and gas companies. And, you know, our members use that information. The companies don't pay us for these, so they're totally our unbiased opinion. And we follow a lot of companies they've heard of and a lot they haven't heard of. So we're constantly looking for the gems that Wall Street isn't quite aware of yet.
So the word is, if you got gas-guzzling cars, you might want to get that second car that is more economical. Dan, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Have yourself a great weekend.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Well, there was another Fed meeting this week. No interest rate hike. We seem to be repeating the patterns of last year where the Fed is ratcheting down its forecast economic growth, which means it can't raise rates, which it told us it was going to do. Nevertheless, it seemed to be making noises as if it's still going to try to do that. We'll hear from Dr. Gary Shilling in the next hour because, as he says, we're approaching the era of the end of economic growth. It's been ongoing for some time, although the establishment has been somewhat slow to reckon with that. It's going to go on for another 6 to 8 years, probably a recession. We're going to stay at historic low interest rates for quite some time, which makes it difficult for savers and investors. What do you do in such an environment? All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.